This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 12th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 162, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show this week, we'll be talking to the head of athlete development for UK sport about how spotting early talent helps bring Olympic gold.
We'll be learning about the history of Asia with author Pankaj Mishra and asking how it shines a light on today's relationship between East and West.
Staying in Asia, we'll be talking to the director of a new documentary on the dissident Chinese artist Ai Weiwei.
To meet Ai Weiwei, I really think, is to, you know, be intrigued. You know, he's incredibly charismatic. He is very bold. He also is sort of enigmatic as well at the same time.
And we'll also chat with Syrian author Samar Yazbek, plus a look ahead to next week's news and, of course, some great music, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
That's all still to come, but we're now joined by Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, for a catch-up on what's on the news agenda for the coming week. Hello, Sophie.
Hello.
You're diving straight in.
I'm diving straight in.
Go for it.
Firstly, I have to qualify this by saying it's August and a lot of people are on holiday. So politically, it can be a bit slow, but there are lots of things happening this week. We think that Lakhdar Brahimi might be announced as Kofi Annan's successor as a UN envoy in Syria. But we're not quite sure, that's just diplomatic sources say. But what is definitely happening is the Puerto Rico referendum, which is happening today.
And what are they referendum-ing about?
Well, it's interesting. It's about statehood, because it's actually part of the US Commonwealth. It's a little archipelago in the Caribbean, but they've been sort of part of that umbrella since 1917. And they're looking at whether or not they want to become actually the 51st state of the United States, or pull back and be independent. So it's a two-part referendum. It's happening today and November. So we'll know more later in the week. Also, tomorrow is Fidel Castro's birthday.
Happy birthday, Fidel.
86.
Not looking a day over 86.
He's been going for a while.
Yeah.
But they'll also be celebrating there. And if they're not celebrating, they'll probably be forced to.
What do you buy an 86-year-old dictator for his birthday?
No, a cigar.
Okay. Yeah.
But then there's a summit. It's kicked off today. We mentioned it last week, about global hunger, which is happening in London. And also the UN is still busy in Geneva. They're debating, they're in a second part of their conference on disarmament. It hasn't been going too well because they can't really agree on or even agree to disagree on who's going to disarm. There are too many contracts, too much global defence infrastructure, too many, it's been so convoluted, this conference. People aren't very hopeful, but nevertheless, they're pressing ahead in Geneva, and that's the UN headquarters there. Friday is something to look forward to.
Anyway, she's just like actually looking at her diary now.
No, I thought she was going to...
And then lunch on Friday.
And I'll tell you something else that's going to be in the week ahead. There's going to be a Friday. Yeah. That's the other thing I've spotted in my diary. There's a Friday this week.
Now, Friday is the day we're going to see the Pussy Riot verdict in Moscow. If anybody hasn't been watching the news, reading the papers, or listening to the likes of Madonna, who came out in support of Pussy Riot, they're the band they're charged with hooliganism motivated by religious hatred. And they did this sort of punk prayer in a cathedral in Moscow. They're expected to get 3 years. And the international pop community and poets and any sort of resistance artists have all been coming out in support of them. So the world is really going to be looking at this verdict to see. It's kind of a litmus test for sort of freedom of expression in Russia. The US embassy there is on high alert. They think there's going to be some violence. So we're going to look at all eyes on Moscow.
And Kofi Annan resigned, didn't he, because of it? Or is that something else?
That's something else.
Are you joking? I'm trying to take it from that to our sports. Look ahead as well.
The trouble is that people believe you, Rob.
I think maybe our listeners are well informed enough to know.
Even though I mean, believe that you actually thought that. So that's what I mean.
And finally, on Saturday, it's Eid. So Ramadan ends, which is kind of bad timing for the Olympics. Now, but it will be a celebration all around the Muslim world. And it's a 3-day sort of feast, really. And you see, we'll see sort of lots of parties and lots of eating.
I've got my Ritz crackers out. Especially.
Well, did you see, actually, there was a good story in Pakistan where Pizza Hut, for many years, they've been doing an all-you-can-eat Ramadan special after 7 p.m. You could go in and eat as many pizzas as you'd like. It seemed that people were eating a bit too much pizza, so they've kind of stopped it this year. They said, you know, actually, we've got a special pizza offer. I think it's one pizza and a Diet Coke, but people are really upset. I thought that was a bit peculiar that you were upset that you went out to eat personally 11 pizzas of an evening. But
I know, and actually we have looked at this in the magazine at sort of how you know, people fast all day but then eat quite a lot as soon as the sun goes down. It isn't that holy in some cases, but Eid can be you know, it differs according to which country you're in. So in sort of South Asia, all the women sort of henna their hands, and it's a very holy sort of actually lots of praying. And then in some countries it's more like a street party.
Thank you. Maybe we should do a religious studies section every week with Sophie Grove.
I think it's rather good, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
I'm spellbound.
Yes, she can come in and give us a... This week we're looking at the Druze.
Well, on the subject of Ramadan, yeah. It's really interesting. Our security guard, Mackie, I was talking to him, and he'd printed out, and he's Muslim, he's Sudanese, and he had printed out his Ramadan calendar for the entire thing. But it tells you when you can have your first... when you've got to stop eating, when you can start eating in the morning. It's rather fascinating. And obviously, as the moon changes, everything, you know, you get up 2 minutes earlier, you can have your sandwich sort of, you know, sort of for 6 minutes earlier on the Friday than you would have it on the Wednesday. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, and it's all on the internet. It's a
and
lot
it's
of fascinating
so lunar.
Thing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Actually, I was reading about in South Africa, they celebrate, all the Muslims and non-Muslims go to Greenpoint and where the moon is out, and they have this kind of lunar celebration as Eid starts happening. And it's so amazing to see that, you know, you can time it. And it's happening globally, so the moon often kind of differs.
It's so lunar.
Yeah.
So that's the pull quote they're going to put
it's
on the back.
Completely lunar.
About Ramadan. It's so lunar. that's fascinating, Sophie. Thanks for telling us that. You've got to stick around, and you've got to poke your oar into the world of sport. And we're going to talk briefly before we start our first feature about our favourite Olympic moments. Earlier this week, I was speaking to a couple of my colleagues out having lunch, and they were saying that basically they were only into the Greco-Roman wrestling after everything had sort of... After they thought they were going to be into the swimming
There are some rather saucy moves in Greco-Roman rowing. Greco-Roman wrestling. Yeah. Yes, I think they were rather taken with that.
What does anyone know the one... I'm not going to do it in here because I'll be too far away from the mic
It's the kind of one with your bottom in the air...
And on all fours.
And your one finger put to the kind of corner of your mouth. That,
the sort of coquettish...
Yes.
Turn around.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've seen that.
Have you seen that, Sophie?
I haven't.
I don't know what it's called, but it's certainly a sport. make no mistake.
I've really enjoyed the rhythmic gymnastics.
Oh, yes, that's
I
wonderful.
I mean, it's amazing. Last week, when I was having my lunch, I was watching this Kazakh lady balance a large ball on her nose like a seal, and that's apparently part of the rhythmic gymnastics.
That's absolutely amazing.
And it was actually very sort of like Cirque du Soleil or something. It was absolutely amazing. That was one of my favourite moments.
Synchronised swimming, oddly good.
Fantastic.
Saw the Egyptian team doing it. It was fascinating that there'd been, you know, a whole revolution in Egypt. But meanwhile, they were diligently getting in the pool, kind of doing their scissoring movements. It was
exactly.
Good.
Exactly. No revolution is complete without, scissoring.
That's a move.
And they're wonderful when they do those expressions. They jump out of the water. And then they have these kind of wonderful sort of wry expressions
so
on their faces.
I know. It's so sort of, they're so on vogue, aren't they?
They're completely voguing in sort of aquatic voguing. Also, I have to say, I was very taken by the women's boxing. Because it was just fantastic to see. Also, we won, the UK won, Nicola Adams. She's such a smiley, lovely person, but when she's in the ring, she's an absolute demon.
Yeah.
And her nemesis is Can Can, who is Chinese flyweight. And it was just an incredible match. And even the Prime Minister was there and cheering them on, which
of
is
China.
Kind of rare, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
That was great. And also on the subject of very charming and slightly gobby athletes, I loved Laura Trott, the cyclist, who slightly reminded me of a of someone, I think, from Britain's Got Talent. Anyway, she was absolutely amazing, and she was so sweet when interviewed. And that's what I've loved about the Olympics as well. The athletes seem to be incredibly sort of humble, apart from Usain Bolt, who's kind of got this mock sort of like arrogant thing about him. Maybe it is completely true, but they all seem really humble and sort of quite well spoken and just so happy to be there. And they're obviously going to probably sell some extra bottles of Head and Shoulders and things for some money off the back of it, but they seem to be very sweet rather than interviewing footballers or any other sports.
Yeah, and I think what the other amazing thing is, I think that comradeship between people from different countries, when you see an event finish, I think quite genuinely, because these people see each other at so many different things, they're incredibly pleased to see each other and happy even for other people who have kind of done well. I watched some of the gymnastics. I got to go, and it was amazing watching as each person came off. The Russians were hugging the Chinese, were hugging the French, were hugging the English. It was brilliant.
Back to the Greco-Roman wrestling, right?
Yes.
That's not hugging.
I can't say what I was going to say.
Is the crying as well. People have just been absolutely letting rip emotionally, and there have been quite a few tears, sobbing, moments of sobbing, which are really kind of my favourite, really.
We've got to stop there, but I think we should all give, before we head to our first guest, Chelsea Wall, who is, by no mistake, the head of athlete development for the UK for Team GB. Let's quickly say what medal we'd give the London Olympics.
I'd give it a gold.
Gold.
Me too.
I'm really impressed.
Three golds. Congratulations. Well done, us.
Get up on the podium.
Sophie Grove, thank you so much for your incredibly enlightening religious knowledge lesson.
Well, thank you for having me, Jack.
and news look ahead and all your sporting glory as well. We're going to see you next week.
See you then.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.
Coming up next, you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Coming up next, we will be speaking to Chelsea Wall, Head of Athlete Development for UK Sport. Now, if the conversation we've just had is anything to go by, you may be aware that the UK has been holding a sporting tournament for the last couple of weeks. What nearly nobody spotted coming was the bountiful haul of Olympic gold medals that Team GB has come away with. However, our first guest makes it her business to spot that early. Chelsea Waugh is Head of Athlete Development for UK Sport. Its Sporting Giants programme helps find athletes and hone them to success. And she's on the line now to tell us how to spot a winner. Chelsea, welcome to the Weekly.
Hello.
Now, it sounds like you're smiling. This is a great start. There's no surprise why. I wonder whether it's almost a surprise to you.
Probably not as much so as, I guess, the general public. I mean, this has been the sort of ultimate applied research project into how to win in elite sport and all the development programs that underpin that for the last, the last decade. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely been by design, not by sheer luck. And I guess the fact that we're seeing so many medals across so many sports helped to, to evidence that.
And you're based in Loughborough, which is the famous, in the UK, the famous sort of sporting academy and sporting university. Has everybody kind of stopped running around and basically been glued to the television for 2 weeks there? Or has everyone been down at the Olympic Park?
Well, I think the nation's been gripped. I certainly know my team's been gripped by what they've been seeing and supporting all the athletes that they've seen these very personal journeys on the last couple of years. And I certainly know everybody at UK Sport, the high performance agency for elite sport in this country. They certainly are gripped. And we're getting alerts pretty much every half an hour about how we're going, the trends analysis, not just nationally but internationally, and how things are unfolding.
And how do you sort of start off with any of our medal winners who might have passed through your doors? When do you start spotting talent, and when can you sort of put your money and your belief really really into an athlete when they're young?
Yeah, well, basically our work at UK Sport and with the English Institute of Sport, where our technical arm of athlete development really sits, it's about working in partnership with the sports in trying to provide them technical advice and technical solutions on how to raise the level of sophistication by which they're actually identifying, confirming and developing their talent. And we've been working with all of the sports for the past 7 years and helping them to put that package of support together and ultimately go out and deliver it. And I guess in terms of the actual identification of athletes, there's a whole array of ways in which we've been helping the sport. Some are more conventional, so how they kind of fish from the domestic talent pool where athletes have already found their way into the sport, through to more unconventional means like Sporting Giants, where we actually did public appeals looking for exceptionally tall people at a phase one criteria. to try and see if we could fast track them through to the London 2012 Olympic Games. So different approaches for different sports, but certainly all hinged on looking at a much more scientific, a much more systematic, and a much more evidence-based approach to how do we know whether someone could actually go and win us a medal or not, and how quickly can we find that out.
Chelsea, I wanted to ask you, that fast-track element is really fascinating. The number of people we've seen interviewed have said, oh, actually, I only took this sport up 3 years ago, 4 years ago. In some instances, only at the beginning of this year, it seemed like a year ago that they began really kind of applying their skills to that sport. Is that something, a lesson we have to kind of learn, that in fact it's not only the kids who have come up, you know, through clubs at 5, 6, 7 years old? Of course that's an advantage, but there is a possibility for people who are good sports people to actually switch disciplines actually much later on in their sporting careers.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's fair to make the assessment that most of our medalists, and certainly our serial gold medalists, these are people that have really undertaken a very long journey, probably something between 8 to 10 years of grind, you know, getting it right, getting it wrong, becoming a scholar of their trade. That's definitely, certainly from all of our research, we know that pursuing excellence at the highest level, and we know it even not in just the sporting arena, but in other domains as well, it's a long journey. And, you know, and thanks to the lottery funding, we're able to invest on an 8-year program and not a 4-year, which is something that's very special to the UK sports system. But what I would say is that there are examples, I think some of the ones that you've noted, where you can actually start a sport, in some sports, not all sports, where you can actually arrive into that sport at what we would call mature age level. And if you've had some sort of prior experience in a related sport, the possibility of being able to be switched at a later age and then going into a very special development environment, it is possible that you can go on and sort of be springboarded to success within a relatively short amount of time. And of course, you know, we saw an example of sort of massive accelerated development in the case of Helen Glover, who of course won our first gold medal on the first week of the Olympic Games, who within as little as 4 years of first getting into a rowing boat was able to, you know, to go on and achieve not only a medal, an Olympic gold medal. So they're rarer, but they are possible. But how you navigate that process and the special development environment that you go into is actually what really counts there.
Chelsea, also, I've been listening to Dave Brailsford, who's in charge of our cycling team, Team GB cycling team. And I'm amazed to hear about some of the techniques, about how he asks his cyclists to sleep in a certain way or eat a bowl of cereal in the morning in a certain way to use certain muscles, or I'm not quite sure what it is. Do you at Athlete Development in Loughborough, do you do that sort of thing, or is it a more general sort of training scheme you do?
We don't specifically train the athletes, but we certainly advise and provide guidance and expert support and technical advice to the sports who actually deliver the training program. So I guess to give you a really good example is across most of the Summer Olympic sports now, we do have what we would call Olympic Development Directors or Performance Pathway Managers who are absolutely responsible for going out and finding, you know, Generation 2016, 2020. And they've been busily working for, you know, over 3-4 years now on the next generation. And our job is to bring those people together on a very frequent basis. We do residentials and we work with them, we educate them, and we study and provide them examples of excellence, development excellence all around the world of, you know, how do you actually identify, how do you confirm, and then what are the key features or the defining features of an exceptional development environment? Because that's what we really know about talent. It's not often the initial blueprint that's that telling really about what someone could do, you know, being tall and having high endurance capabilities in rowing is actually really important. But actually the real deal breaking bit comes when you get into these, you know, very specialist development incubators and how those coaches and support staff and the leadership, as you talked about, and Dave Brailsford, how they navigate you through this, you know, fairly remarkable journey that, you know, most don't make. And so we Sorry
to interrupt. I just want to finally, obviously, the success at the London Games is going to have a wonderful honeymoon effect. We're sort of told it. Well, it is for getting lots of young people into sport, especially athletics, the sort of sports that maybe aren't on the TV, aren't maybe as popular as football and things like that. Does sort of athlete development, do you guys at UK Sport need a bit of a honeymoon period as well? I mean, there must be a lot of kind of cold, rainy Tuesdays when you're working with athletes. This sort of stuff must make you realise that everything's worthwhile as well.
Well, very much so. You know, there's nothing more special than seeing an athlete first identified in a program. They choose a lifestyle that's, you know, most people would never even think about undertaking, and then they achieve, you know, a medal, and even more importantly, when they achieve a gold medal, of course, the very precious ones. And there is nothing better than that. And we do look at those athletes and those coaches and those support programs with massive admiration. But I guess what's really interesting for us is that I actually think we're probably only on about 3 or 5 cylinders, particularly about our development programs in the elite sports system in the UK. I think we're doing well. I think there's another big gear to go, and we've certainly been working on that the last 2 years. And I think, you know, the true test of great, you know, elite development programs is that, you know, post the holding the home Olympic Games, that we will see our medal tally be able to maintain, and the next generation actually come through and step up to the plate as well. So I think it's pretty exciting times, actually. I think certainly this helps the momentum. It helps people to see, you know, a more systematic, a more evidence-based way. Reducing the luck factor of finding and developing people is actually how you win elite in elite sport, or one of the key factors. And we look forward to working with all the sports in the forward to go another gear.
Well, Chelsea Waugh, Head of Athlete Development for UK Sport, we should thank you for joining us on the line. Also, thank you for all your hard work. So I guess the Olympics is a bit like the iceberg, and there's lots of hard work underneath. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your time.
Cheers. Andrew, should we have some music now?
Please.
We're going to have Lemonade. These are a new band from New York City.
Because that's quite refreshing after you've just done a run.
Yeah. Also, guess what the song's called? Ice Water.
Ooh.
Oh, yes. I love it when a plan comes together. New from New York's Lemonade, from their record called Diver. That was Ice Water. Do we like that?
I like that very much. You were kind of jiggling in your seat.
I was, wasn't I? I yeah. Won't tell you why. It wasn't because of the music. You can get cream for it.
Okay.
I don't know how to make the link between a sort of trio of kind of trendy New York electro popsters and Pankaj Mishra, author of The Ruins of Empire.
I think perhaps best not.
But he is coming up after this.
The ideas of East and West have long defined world politics, be it the ideological shoulder-rubbing of superpowers like China and the US, or the current military muscle being flexed by alliances in regions from Afghanistan to Australia. Our next guest is an author whose new book, From the Ruins of Empire, aims to explain the history behind Asia's relationship with the West. Pankaj Mishra has looked back over 200 years to highlight the historic figures who helped make up today's political landscape. And he joins us on the line now. Pankaj, thank you so much for joining us today. First of all, I wanted to ask you, you tell the story of Asia literally from Turkey all the way through to Japan. What were the common themes you felt held together this kind of region? I think that many of us may think of in quite disparate ways.
I think the one experience that people from Turkey all the way to Japan shared in the late 19th century and early 20th century was the fact of Western domination, or this extraordinary fact of Western presence in their lives, and the question, the challenge of how to respond to it effectively. And in that, Japan was a great example for you know, Asians, right from sort of Muslims in Egypt and the Sudan to people in the Malay Peninsula and, of course, in India and you know, sort of in sometimes very remote places where Japan was seen as a country that had successfully met the challenge of Western power, had modernized itself. So this is really the sort of this particular aspect that all Asians could respond to.
And Pankaj, it's interesting when you talk about Japan, there's a great bit in the book where you describe a kind of Tokyo that many of us may not recognise today. Anyway, it seemed there were these very metropolitan spots where people were coming from all over Asia to try and kind of breathe in the kind of the air of Japan, to see what it was about the country that they could take home as inspiration.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, the book really describes a cosmopolitan moment in Asian history where, you know, the nation states that we now know, for instance, China or even Turkey for that matter, Turkey was then, of course, part of the Ottoman Empire, they hadn't really come into being. So people travel extremely widely and shared notes and shared experiences. And of course, Japan became a mecca for Asians after it defeated Russia in 1905, completely, very effectively demonstrating that this can be done, that, you know, very superior European country with superior firepower can be defeated militarily. And this actually made a lot of people sit up and say, well, what is the secret of Japan? And then people actually traveled to Tokyo to learn those secrets. So Tokyo became the center for people from all across Asia, you know, Egyptian students, Indian students, Indonesian, Javanese students, all kinds of people. The Vietnamese, the first generation of Vietnamese nationalists showed up there. So this is really this sort of slightly hidden history that this book uncovers.
Now, many of us have been read books and seen people writing about the kind of the roots of Al-Qaeda, and most people don't trace it back that far. You know, perhaps some people think it's a reaction to events that surround contemporary Israel, but you hint that actually its roots and the idea of a kind of a unified Muslim world fighting back against the West and using perhaps military means or attack, actually you can trace back much longer than that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, Al-Qaeda is obviously an extreme and a rather vicious manifestation of certain political tendencies in the Muslim world. But the fact is that these tendencies, these have been around for a much longer time than we imagine. And they go back all the way to the late 19th century when many Muslim countries, Egypt and Turkey, Egypt in particular, which was faced with a British occupation in 1882, where, and of course, India was also regarded as a Muslim country. It has a large Muslim population and it was under occupation by the British. So the whole idea of how to respond to the West and whether there could be something like pan-Islamism, Muslim nations, Muslim peoples all across the world joining in solidarity against the imperialist West, these ideas were floated back then. And actually, a lot of them were a direct response to the way Muslims felt that European powers ganged together in pressurizing the Ottomans, for instance, in Istanbul, and the way they protected their Christian minorities within the Ottoman Empire. So the idea of pan-Islamism, which I trace back to this particular moment, really goes back to the late 19th century, and people saying, why can't we organize the way the Europeans do on the basis of a shared religion and a shared ethnicity?
Pankaj, the subtitle of your book is The Revolt Against the West and the Remaking of Asia. Is that revolt sort of something that sort of intellectuals and historians and sort of history is interested in? Or do you think it's a feeling on the ground in some of the cities that you mention in the book? Do you think there's a kind of sense of revolt and wanting to give the West a bash on the nose?
This feeling has certainly moderated over the years, but one should never underestimate the power of anti-Western nationalism in places like China, for instance. We see, you know, instances of that practically every day. You know, just the way the Chinese have responded to the allegedly bad treatment of their athletes at the London Olympics, the way the Turks often respond to the way they are treated by Israel, you know, a couple of years back when the flotilla was attacked by the Israelis and the whole country erupted in sort of with this anti-Israel and anti-Western sentiment. So I think these feelings have been simmering for a long time, and obviously, you know, anti-nationalists, anti-Westernism often offers a kind of glue for national identity in a lot of these countries. And I think people in the West are largely unaware of these feelings. They just have this slightly innocent idea that they're all, you know, trying to be a bit like us. They're not.
And Pankaj, I wanted to ask about a small thing that's highlighted on the book's jacket, which is the fact that you divide your time between London and Shimla. So is that a kind of fascinating place to be writing about all these events? Because obviously we know Shimla as this outpost that was built up by the British as a kind of a summer residence for the Raj to escape the heat of Delhi. And there you are sitting in that town looking back over all this history. Did it add to your story?
Unfortunately, Shimla's imperial privileges are not quite available to me at this point. Actually, I live in a village which is north of Shimla, so I live without the panoply of imperial power. But it's certainly a great place to write in because it's very quiet, and I have the most fantastic view, I think I can say safely, in the world. So I think, and you know, I think moving between societies, moving between cultures, opens up, you know, certain perspectives which may not have been available to me if I was confined to just one place.
And interestingly, again, writing from the perspective of India and looking at this story that swirls around, because, you know, much of India's contemporary history has been a reaction to what's happened in the more Muslim nations that surround India. But again, you found that that was a common thread that actually united, say, Pakistan, contemporary Pakistan and India and Bangladesh and all these other countries as well.
For a long time, until the formation of nation states, and, you know, one has to remember how quickly Pakistan, for instance, came into being in the 1940s. Pakistan wasn't at all on the horizon, and it was really in the sort of circumstances surrounding the departure of the British, you know, quite a disastrous scenario in which Pakistan was kind of created overnight, literally overnight. So until that moment, Hindus and Muslims were, you know, more or less united in wanting to see the British depart and to basically, you know, run sort of have an independent country or independent countries or a more federal country in that part of the world. It's the nation state is the in many ways interrupts this particular history of cosmopolitan struggles.
Well, Pankaj, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. That was Pankaj Mishra, who's the author of the new book, From the Ruins of Empire. And stay around because we're going to be talking Syria next.
You're back with The Weekly. Now, recently here at Monocle 24, we were visited by a journalist and writer from Syria whose intellectual and liberal viewpoint has made her public role living under an oppressive regime no longer possible. Sama Yazbek is a dissident whose latest book, A Woman in the Crossfire, details the real dangers she's experienced while speaking out in Syria. With the help of an interpreter, she chatted about her experience to Sophie Grove.
Tell me about the shift from peace to what's happening, the uprisings. When did you first start to notice the dissent in society in Damascus and the whole of Syria? And how did the uprisings really start, in your view, from your perspective?
It started even before the revolution in Syria, because we started to organize and be in sit-ins to support Libya and Tunisia and Egypt. And then I felt that something will be happening in Syria as well, only then. And I started writing small comments or statements, but then I felt a responsibility to actually start to documenting what is happening because of especially of the media distortion that the regime was using. I came out in demonstrations with other people, with everyone else, and I saw in my own eyes firsthand the killings against the peaceful demonstrators. And I thought it's very unfair and very brutal.
And you were a witness yourself and you chose to get involved. Were you aware of the personal risk that that posed to you and your family? And why did you decide to overcome that fear and to put yourself in the middle of the revolution?
It's not like something that I came from outside to get involved in. I was very interested in the changing process. I saw people who really were calling for justice. It's also my dream because I am part of these people. And I felt as well the responsibility as an intellect to get more involved and to take my responsibility because I belong to people naturally and it's also my dream to achieve justice in the society.
In the book, you talk about your disappointment in the intellectual elite, at least some of the intellectual elite who haven't joined the revolution and haven't been that intellectual voice. Do you still blame them in many ways for not joining in?
It was only at the beginning, actually, where the intellects were very far away from the movement, from the popular movement. But then again, a lot of them participated and started like to get involved gradually. A lot of these people of the intellects are actually supporting the revolution, but they are keeping low profile just to be away from the secret intelligence services and can keep going on and helping the revolution in the best way possible.
And while you were documenting the events and the protests, you saw and you witnessed some horrific acts of violence just in the street, a kind of spontaneous violence almost. Damascus changed into this carnival of death, you were saying, and you used that phrase a couple of times. I wondered, what's that like and what did you actually see just on the streets where you lived?
I was in a state of shock.
It was very shocking to see this brutality in front of you. We knew from before that the regime was brutal, and was practicing that brutality on people, but it's the first time that you see it in front of your eyes, in broad light, in front of everybody. So it was really a shock, and that's what driven me to write about it.
مشاعر الخوف ومشاعر الألم وهي نفس الصدمة اللي دفعتني إني أكتب.
And there's one instance early on in your memoirs where you are in the street and you see the security, well, a mob, just pull up and start beating a father and his 10-year-old. And then they just cut him off in a car and you're left with this 4-year-old who is looking for his father and his brother and has just seen this terrible thing. Yeah. What happens to a child like that? And he was in your care. What happens to him? Where is he now?
It was very brutal. That was another shock to me. The boy has returned to his father and his family now. If he was left with nobody to take care of and hide, imagine how would it be? It's really shocking. And these kind of incidents, exactly what made me write about everything I saw. The violence I saw in the streets actually made me more determined to work on documentation, documenting everything that is happening from a writer point of view, because I thought it has a better impact on people and on public opinion.
And that was Sophie Grove speaking to Sama Yazbek, the author of A Woman in the Crossfire. Stay with us. We're going to be speaking about Alison Clayman's new film about Ai Weiwei up next.
On the latest episode of Section D, we visit the Philippines to hear how local craft is making big business in Europe. We drop in on the Istanbul Collectors Club, where 100 members collect everything from apple peelers to diving suits. And over in New York, we visit the studio of architect Morris Adjmi to hear about the objects that inspire him.
I mean, I love the city and I love the anonymous buildings. And so I think that that's where I draw most of my influence from.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. Now, the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has become a figurehead for the uneasy relationship between creative minds and the Chinese government. He treads an unusual line, having helped create the iconic Beijing Bird's Nest Olympic Stadium, yet constantly watched, analysed, and some would say censored by the state. American filmmaker Alison Clayman's new documentary, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, is the account of Clayman's four-year friendship with the artist. She spoke to Monocle's Tom Edwards about getting to know an icon.
Alison, I'd like to just ask you, first of all, I mean, just to sort of remind us about how it came to be that you were in a position to sort of make this film, because obviously it's a very sort of intimate portrait of a very outspoken critic of, you know, the Chinese state. And how did you come to be able to have this astonishing access?
Yeah, well, with such kinds of things, it may often be the case that there's a unique and personal story behind it, and such is the case here. I was already living in China for 2 years when I had the chance to meet Ai Weiwei. I went there as a sort of aspiring journalist and documentary filmmaker, but I had no background in China, so I had been sort of very frantically trying to have adventures and take jobs where I had to learn Mandarin as I went along. And, you know, fast forward to 2008, and my roommate was curating an exhibition of his photographs for a local gallery, and she asked if I wanted to help and make a video to accompany the show. She felt like it would help illuminate the context behind the work, which was actually the photographs from the decade that Ai Weiwei lived in New York in the 1980s. So my sort of own introduction to him was really through these photographs that had so far gone unpublished, but really illuminated an important part of his life and his, you know, the role of photography in his artistic practice. And she said, you know, would you like to help out and make a video to go with the show? And I, you know, jumped at the chance because I was this, you know, aspiring filmmaker and wanted to get my feet wet and use my camera. And so December 2008, I started coming along to Weiwei's studio along with the gallery staff in order to make this short piece. And to meet Ai Weiwei, I really think, is to be intrigued. You know, he's incredibly charismatic. You know, he is very bold. He also is sort of enigmatic as well at the same time. And, you know, I felt like I was both really captivated and also really curious to know more about him and certainly, as he was talking about censorship in China and his activities online and his upcoming earthquake campaign and all these things, I just felt like I really wanted to, you know, continue on and see what happens. And I think that the fact that we were able to make a good relationship from the beginning, and that I had this very open attitude and I would continue to come around, and I did news reports about what he was doing, but I was also kind of interested in filming a lot more than that. And, you know, he just kind of let it happen. So it really evolved in a very, very organic way at the beginning.
Now, you mentioned there a number of facets of his personality. He's obviously hugely charismatic, but you mentioned that he's something of an enigma. And I wonder, spending this amount of time with him, documenting his life in this very intimate way, what sense do you have now of his personality? Do you feel you understand him as an artist and as a person differently than you did in those early days in 2008?
Absolutely. I really think that I feel like I have a much more empirical view of him, that, you know, everything is sort of based on the evidence of several years together and what I sort of witnessed. For example, you know, something that he was talking about already pretty early on, he was talking a lot about speaking out for others, and the idea that he had reached this position in his life and what was important to him was free speech and transparency and rule of law, and that's what his activities are kind of trying to essentially raise consciousness and bring people into the conversation and speaking for others. And immediately that makes me kind of wary, you know. I'm like curious, okay, like, are you really speaking for others? You know, who wants you to do that? I mean, I think that you have to bring a good deal of skepticism to a project like this, and a figure like him, who's also incredibly media savvy and someone who likes to be playful, which is great, and again, why he's such a great figure to be at the center of a film. But, you know, his company is called Fake Design. A lot of his work deals with questions of authenticity and fake and real, and Warhol is sort of one of his influences. And so you have to kind of, I think you have to bring kind of a skeptical eye to everything. What I really believe that I found is someone who is very genuinely interested in these issues and very genuinely is putting himself on the line in order to kind of further these causes and kind of, again, try to bring people into the conversation to kind of say, you know, we need to safeguard these universal values. We need to use our voice. We need to respect individual life and individual voices. But I didn't know that at the beginning. I certainly didn't think that's what the movie was about necessarily. You know, I feel like it is a really good way to go into something and not in your head think you know what the story is. That's, to me, that's what documentary was. It was a chance to follow the story as it unfolds. And I think that's what I did, and that's why I think, you know, what I know now, I feel like, is quite evidence-based and not just, like, the story that I wanted to tell at the outset.
Now, I'm going to ask you about censorship and how Ai Weiwei works within that context in China in a moment, but I just wondered at first, as a filmmaker, what kind of challenges did that present to you, the issues of government intervention, censorship in China? Was it a very complex process? Was it a lot of different challenges than you'd faced before whilst making video work?
Right, well, I think that that's another reason why it was kind of maybe, you know, a case of the right project and the right person kind of to do it, because I already had 2 years of experience living in China, and even though I wasn't working as a reporter the entire time, that was always kind of my goal. And by the time I began filming with him, I was very familiar with kind of what the rights are of, you know, foreign correspondents, and I actually had a journalist accreditation at that time. And going along with that, I also had learned from my other colleagues, you know, other journalists in China, the idea that you have to sort of be careful and realize your position within the system, realize that you could put sources and subjects at risk, and like to take great care with the way that you're operating. So I really feel like I, you know, came into it with all of these kind of concerns and all of the kind of ways that I did know how you could kind of push the limits. But again, to be around Ai Weiwei, I think is an extra, it can kind of embolden you in an extra way. And I do think that, you know, watching how he feels completely justified to be documenting life, and, you know, in the face of police, he doesn't flinch and doesn't want to put his camera down. And so I do think that can rub off on the people around him. As a practice, I actually did not experience that much intervention. So my I guess my point is, I also think there was probably a way to go about making a movie about Ai Weiwei where you could run into more trouble, where maybe you could be less cautious and have difficulty. I certainly wasn't advertising the project. There was no website or Facebook page or Twitter feed, you know, for the film until, you know, we were well into post-production. But the only times when we really had to deal, or when I had really had to deal with the authorities, were on these trips to Chengdu, which are in the film, where, you know, Ai Weiwei is returning to seek justice over a police assault case where he was hit in the head. And so the entire purpose of the trip was to go to the police stations and the courthouses and the seats of authority and request an investigation, request a lawsuit, request some kind of action be taken. And so those trips, for sure, I ran into the police officers taking my camera, forcing me to delete tapes, all that kind of stuff. But by then, you know, I had enough kind of tricks that no important footage was lost.
I wanted to ask you about Ai Weiwei, something you've touched upon already, which is how media savvy he is. He's now kind of cast more as this sort of leading Chinese dissident almost. Do you feel that the film ever revealed anything different about that? Did it sort of reveal him to be an artist who sort of stumbled upon this role as a dissident, or do you feel it was very much something that he was always focused on? His work was about speaking for others, it was about challenging censorship. There's not a sense that there's any kind of, I don't know, cynical manipulation of events to cast himself this way. You feel he's a very genuine character in this way?
I mean, absolutely, and I feel like that conclusion for me is really strengthened by the fact that I was ready to find the opposite and tell the story of the opposite, you know, if that was the case. You know, the question of whether or not he's a dissident, I mean, was something that I was already thinking about in the first year of filming, because as I read a little bit of, you know, the press coverage he had received already at that point, and certainly around the Olympics when he spoke out as a co-designer of the Bird's Nest, you know, boycotts the games and all the criticisms he had. I mean, you can find that in media coverage, certainly foreign media coverage, like a tendency to kind of jump to those labels. Yeah, really, to call him a dissident, I think at a time when it was premature, although I wouldn't have called it premature, I just said it doesn't fit, you know, like they're trying to apply this label that I'm not really sure fits. You know, he's an artist who is socially conscious and not afraid to speak his mind, but I'm not sure he's a dissident. And we would talk about it, and he would agree. You know, 2009 and even into 2010, you know, this idea that he's not really sure that that is the right kind of descriptor, and it's kind of a case of other people trying to fit him into a convenient box for a news story. What I think the film ends up being about, and you couldn't have known, is the series of events that I really do think has led to the point where it is kind of a fitting descriptor. I mean, once you're detained for 81 days by your government and they refuse to return your passport, I mean, I kind of think he's at the point where there's a fitting label, but you know, the way that he got there was certainly not just by his own devices that he decided that's what he is going to be. It's a series of events that take place where the authorities have just as much agency in creating the story as he does. It's really a lot of action-reaction. That's what the movie ends up being, really kind of dramatic, because, you know, he does something to push it, they crack down. You know, he does something to push it more, they respond. And I don't see how anyone could orchestrate that, you know, and I also don't see why anyone would want to, because he is, you know, ultimately his situation right now is not desirable, and I think he would much rather be a freer person and be able to create his artwork and travel with it. That ends up being the evolution and the story of the film, and I really did think when it began, I wasn't sure that that was the right kind of way to look at him, and I think that events transpired that kind of brought us to that point.
And that was Monocle's Tom Edwards talking to Alison Clayman, director of Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry.
We're nearly at the end of the road, Andrew.
Well, at the end of the track.
Yeah.
Well, we are at the end of the track because the Olympics finishes today.
I know. What's the closing ceremony? All eyes are going to be on that. What do you think is going to happen? Brian May on the top of Buckingham Palace again?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. We met the other day the mayor of Rio, who was in town, and he's a bit worried. He thinks that Boris might do something strange, and he gives him the flag.
Yeah, because it's funny because Eduardo is the mayor, isn't he?
Yeah, Eduardo Paes.
He's quite up for a laugh, isn't he? We've met him before in Rio. We've been lucky to sort of hang out with him a bit. And he's an amusing character. A bit. He's not Boris-ish, but I think he wants to look serious, doesn't he? For the international stage.
Yeah, he's not Boris. He realizes he's going to be standing in the middle of a stadium with 80,000 people with just Boris and I think one other Olympic
arriving
official
on a zip line or something.
And I think he's a bit scared what's going to happen. But then I presume that I hear there's quite a few Brazilian acts who are in town at the moment who are going to be surprise guests there on tonight.
Yeah, that'd be something to look forward to. This week's show, let's thank our producer Paul Noble and Tom Hall. We'll be back same time next week, same place.
I'll be here. I'm waiting for you, Rob.
I was going to be in here with the air conditioning off
okay.
for once. See if anyone notices. Thank you very much for tuning in. I've been Robert Bound.
And I've been Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.